Hey, everybody, welcome to a special episode of the OIG Roundtable. You know, normally we have Matt Kachansky and Wade McFall, and we do our weekly OIG Roundtables. And this week we've given them a break, and we're doing a New York takeover. It's kind of like when you go to a craft brewery and they have the tap takeover. We're having a tap takeover, and it's OIG Roundtable New York Takeover Edition. As New Yorkers, we're taking charge, no names. And we're not wearing masks. We're going to come out and show you who we are. So I'm joined by three great people that I worked with for a really long time. I know these guys personally. I know them professionally. Jason Eisengrind, for those of you that remember Jason, Jason is our special director here. He does a lot of special projects for us here at Advise. He is a retired special agent in charge from OIG out of headquarters, and then went on to be the Western UPIC director, and then came over here and does special projects. And as those of you know, Jason was my mentor. We're going to talk a lot about mentoring. He was my mentor when I first came over to OIG in 1997, and then I got to work with him for a couple of years. Then he became an assistant special agent charge and was my my direct supervisor, and then went on to be a special agent charge in headquarters. And so we've got Jason. We're talking about mentoring, and then we've got, for those of you that may or may not have seen any of our LinkedIn posts, April Cameron, who retired about a year ago. She spent 25 years over at OIG as an agent. I got to work a lot with April over the years. She spent a lot of time in the New York office working a lot of cases, child support, which is something a lot of people don't realize that we do at the OIG, as well as traditional healthcare cases. April retired about a year ago, and she is our New York SIU director, which means that she's kind of the face of the SIU plans and interacts with a lot of the New York clients and a lot of the state regulatory people. And then finally, our newest SIU investigator who just joined us a few months ago, Adam Golden. Adam is also recently retired OIG agent out of New York. He and April actually worked together for many, many years. And Adam, we're super glad to have you here, new to retirement. And for those of you that have not had an opportunity to interact or meet Adam, Adam is a retired agent from OIG prior to being an agent at the OIG, where he was with us from 2011 until retiring. He was a postal inspector. Postal Inspection Service is a great agency. For those of you that don't know much about it, I encourage you to do research about Postal Inspection Service. And as I like to say, Adam is a reformed lawyer. Who went to law school, and I think you escaped very quickly, right? Is that not true?
It took about a year, but yes.
You woke up one day and you said, this is crazy. I can't do this. I need to do something else with my life. So Adam, welcome to Advise, because I know you've only been here a few months. You're still kind of figuring things out from the SIU perspective and the investigative perspective. But, you know, Adam had a great 25 plus year career as a criminal investigator, as an agent working healthcare for a good chunk of that time. And he's now on our SIU team, helping some of our SIU related clients. So, you know, what we want to do is for this special episode of the OIG Roundtable, and I mean, this is OIG in its most purest form. And we're calling it the New York Takeover because we are all New Yorkers, all four of us. And we all worked in the New York region, working on the criminal, civil, and administrative cases. And so, Jason, I want to start with you because, you know, in the SIU space, one of the things that we constantly are seeing as an issue where there is an area for improvement is mentoring. And mentoring, you really could never put enough importance on mentoring. And I say all the time, you know, Jason is like a father figure to me. And I always say, I don't know if I would give him a kidney. I think about it. I might, you know, take a day or two and see, and then, you know, maybe I give him a kidney and then we see where it goes. But mentoring is an important piece of the investigative continuum. It's really not just about the cases, but in order to become a good investigator, in order to kind of get your feet wet, mentoring becomes a piece of that. And mentoring really is, and it is a career long thing that you get involved with, and it kind of never ends. And it may not be a formal process as time goes on. It's certainly part of that continuum. So Jason, let's start with that. You were a mentor to me, you were a mentor to others. I turned out to become a mentor along the way, and you have mentored a lot of the people that are here. Let's talk a little bit about the framework of mentoring. Why is it important? Why does continuing mentoring become an important part in this space? And particularly because you could never become omnipotent with respect to all things fraud, waste, and abuse.
Thank you. So mentoring is, as you said a mission critical function. It is a very important in the very beginning, but as you mentioned, it's a career-long effort that needs to constantly be used to keep everyone producing the work product that you want in the time that you want it. As far as upfront, a lot of money is spent on hiring people. And you want, of course, to hire the best and brightest folks. And sometimes because our processes are somewhat protracted, right? I mean, the average investigation, probably a couple of years at a minimum, it would take a long time to find out that one of those best and brightest people that we hired really wasn't performing at the level that we wanted. So it must be, though, a process. It has to be codified. So it can't just be shoot from the hips that, you know, here's your mentor, Eric, and Eric goes on the way. First off, the mentor, him or herself, may say, well, wait a minute, I didn't sign on for this. What additional salary am I getting to become a mentor? What is my responsibility? Will this be something that I'm rated on? Things of that nature. So you need to identify the process. And then I would say you make it an accountable process. I'll say that one mentoring system that we put in place at a previous employer of mine, we wanted to have some key elements that were important to the job function, and both the person being mentored as well as the mentor signs off with a, you know, initials and date of when that was achieved. So again, maybe the mentor isn't doing his or her job. You can go back and say, well, wait a minute, this person has no clue about interviewing. How is this possible? And you can see that, in fact, they, you know, they received that component. But point is that it's a structured process, and one that, as Eric said, and is bears repeating, is that it's a career-long effort.
You know, and the one thing, Jason, that always came to mind was, you know, we did have at the OIG, we had a formal mentoring program. You know, I know when you were my mentor, it was not a formalized program in the same sense. It was formal in the sense that you were assigned to be my mentor, and there were things that you were told, you know, had to be done. But when I became a mentor, it was a more formal process. It was a 3-day training. There was a checklist, and it kind of created an environment where you can get people trained on things and a checklist and kind of get them from point to point. Do you find, and you know, and I know you're familiar because you were at headquarters for a portion of the time that was going on, do you find that a formalized process made mentoring better? Informal was better, or maybe there's a hybrid that needs to be there?
I would say the short answer is a hybrid. But what I'll say is that there should be if you have a very large organization, I would say that there has to be an organization-wide mentoring program with major components within it. Maybe it's the sign-off sheets. Maybe it's, you know, any number of things that would be common across many offices. But for the four of us, we know that New York is very special. So, you know, a mentoring that's occurring in Oregon may or may not be very relevant to something that's going on in New York. So, you know, for instance, the way prisoners are processed in the Eastern District versus the Southern District is different, and all types of variables. So think, let's put it into a healthcare context, and let's think of LCDs, right? There's diagnoses, and then there's local coverages. So, you know, you have to make it specific for the environment in which they're actually operating.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And to an extent, you know, one of the benefits, I think, of having been in a large office like New York, where we were working in primarily the New York metro area, is the variety of cases that were out there: criminal, civil, administrative. You could be working a healthcare case, you could be working a kickback case, you could be working a money laundering case, you know, the potential of organized crime. In the post 9/11 world, we were all working some cases that might have had tangential connections back to terrorism and things of that sort. And so the mentoring process is going to be very different. Someone who's working in a small office of maybe 2 or 3 agents, particularly in a region where maybe they're doing more administrative cases or civil cases, maybe a lot of the things that they would get as part of a mentoring training checkoff don't exist, right? If you're an agent who's in a small office in which you're working a bunch of key TAMs or civil cases, maybe you've never done a search warrant. Maybe you don't even know how to do one because you've never done one, right? So these mentoring things have to really be tailored to kind of get to where you need to be, which then, you know, leads itself to the fact that New York was a unique place. I would say that we were in a region where we didn't really give much of a crap about the way that other things in the country ran. We had a policy that was followed, and you know, we did things maybe a little differently. I'm not saying we did things, you know, as Jason says all the time, you know, there's a lot of Jasonisms. Someday we're going to put that book together. And Jason would say, as long as they're not asking you to remove nuclear material without proper protective equipment, or what you're being asked to do is an illegal, immoral, or unethical, it's okay. And there's a lot of truth to that. And so the mentoring has to be tailored to the organization where you are, but also to some of those regional norms that might exist. Investigators in an SIU of three people are going to be treated differently than an SIU of maybe 50 or 100 people, or your larger plans where they have 400 and 500 people that are doing the investigations. And so, April, I want to go to you, because then the next piece of that is, you know, you get mentored, you go through your career, and then you go and you retire. And the biggest thing is when you've spent a large portion of your career working primarily Medicare cases, and you could put this even in the SIU space, what if you came from a plan where all you did was behavioral health, or all you did was DME, or all you did was this? And now you have to come and you have to kind of expand. You know, we have within our suite of clients, we are doing work in the commercial space, Medicare Advantage, Medicaid space. And one of the things really is we have a large concentration of plans that are in the New York metro area and New York State. And those are unique because they all have reporting requirements that go up to New York State's Office of Medicaid Inspector General and some different things in that. And one of the biggest challenges I think that we find is that when you've got, let's say a half a dozen plans, the policies, the procedures, ultimately the reporting all becomes the same, but there are going to be nuances, right? And you spend a lot of time as the New York director kind of interfacing with a lot of the compliance people and the leadership of these plans, mostly because they may have different perspectives on ROI that you have to help communicate down to the leads and the people that are kind of doing the work, right? Because one plan's idea of ROI might be savings. Another plan's ROI might be actual dollars in the door. And the biggest challenge, I think it was certainly for me, and I'm sure for you in the early stage of you being here, was kind of getting that flavor and that feeling and how, you know, interacting with these plans. And so talk a little bit about when you're, you know, think about it in the SIU space, when you go from one plan to another, the learning curve is high, and your learning curve was very high, as all of ours were, because you was going from something new to something very new. Talk a little bit about how, you know, how you kind of dealt with some of those challenges.
Thank you, Eric. And thank you, Jason, too. Like, I wanted to start by saying, like, we've talked about this before, that Jason was my first ASAC, and Eric, you were my first mentor. And I joined the government at OIG in 1998 when there were not a lot of women. So I had a lot of negativity, and I was able to still navigate and learn the job because you two were willing to jump in and show me the ropes and show me how to do like a proper investigation. So kudos to you guys for understanding mentoring in 1998. For us here at the New York SIU, It was definitely a big challenge for me to come and learn, like a completely different way of doing things, and learn all the clients that we have in New York. What I do appreciate is that our whole team here are all mentors. So we have so many different backgrounds, we have so many different expertise areas, and we have such positive attitudes that I can reach out to anyone at any point and ask them for some guidance on understanding what is it that this plan needs and why is it different from another plan? And then we also have like the newer investigators come in. We pair them up with other mentors, you know, to work cases with. So we have, I think the best thing to do is just to make sure that you have mentors and mentees that mesh well together. And if you don't, just to have that conversation. So I have spent the last year and a half learning from the staff in New York, because there are so many different things and it's done very differently than we would work an investigation with OIG. And I see these newer interns and I see these young junior investigators, and I just want to jump in and say, what do you need? How can we get you where you need to be? Ask the questions. And our team is amazing at jumping in and helping out everybody, even if it's seasoned investigators that just don't have a particular expertise in a certain area.
So are you basically saying that New Yorkers are actually congenial people and that this is a bunch of malarkey?
I'm saying that Advise New York SIU is the best. We rock. We do. We have a great staff that is genuinely interested in moving things forward. And like you said before, New York is definitely much more fast-paced, get things done, handle it, ask questions later. And I think I've seen that transfer from OIG, the New York office, to the New York SIU at Advise. Like, we have that, where even though not everyone is located in New York, we have that mentality where everybody jumps in to get everything done, help each other out, and handle what needs to be done to move on to the next thing.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, coupling that with the fact that we do have a good concentration of New Yorkers on our New York teams, right? For a lot of reasons, but part of that is also personality driven, that when we have New York plans, and New York plans tend to have, right, the leadership is New York based, we're a fast paced organization of people. You know, I always say, as New Yorkers, sometimes we have nowhere to go, but we always got somewhere to be. And, you know, lead, follower, get out of the way. And like, you know, when I'm walking down the street, like, please move left or please move right. I need to get to that corner, even though I don't need to get to that corner as fast as I'm walking. I need to get there. And I think that that, you know, and that's part of it. And when we're talking about mentoring, and we're talking about working with these plans, but part of mentoring is making sure that the people that are the mentor and the mentees are good meshes in the personality, that you get along, you can, you know, get through that stuff, taking the criticism and all of that. I remember, you know, I was a federal probation officer in my first life. I did a lot of report writing. I was a good writer. And I write one of my first interview reports or something, and I give it to Jason as my mentor, because Jason says, look, I'm your guide. You can either use me or not use me. And he hands me back an interview report that I had typed up and printed, and it was full of red. And he said, don't worry. Red is the color of hope. I hope you do better next time. And I was like, you know, I went home that night and I was like, this son of a gun.
Did you cry, Eric?
I mean, they were alligator tears, because I knew that, you know, I was going to. So, but, you know, the point is that you have to be in a position to be able to take, you know, and a lot of it was in my last life, who was my audience that I was writing for? It was really just about learning how to write for the audience. But, you know, part of that is having a mentor and a mentee that mesh well. And then also it's finding investigators that are going to mesh well with that plan, right? We have plans all over the country. We have investigators that are all over the country. And one of the things I think that we've become pretty good at doing is matching up the investigators to the plans, so that you're dealing with like personalities, right? Our Midwest plans, a lot of the investigators on those teams are Midwest people. They kind of speak the same language. And so part of being in that SIU is kind of understanding that. And I think one of the things that that becomes a challenge when people go from working primarily one type of violation or one type of fraud scheme to another is you've got to be able to turn on the dime. Like, you could be really good at doing cardiology cases, but every cardiology case is going to have its own set of nuances that are going to be different. And so, you know, I tend to not really appreciate when people say, well, you know, I don't know anything about this. It's like, okay, well, we all didn't know anything about this when we started, right? You kind of have to figure it out, which then is a great, it's good how I segue onto these things.
I also want to add the mentorship as far as dealing with the different clients, because as their needs change, they need to kind of mentor us in what those needs are, and we need to adjust accordingly. So based on the ROI, whether it's a like an offset or a straight refund, Right. We kind of all need to work together. So the mentorship works both ways with the staff and with the clients.
And that's a great point, April, because that's really the truth is that, you know, we can call it anything that we want to call it, but ultimately it really is a version of mentoring because when you, you know, we sign our agreements, we have our contracts with these payers and really those contracts are for us to do the SIU work and do what we need to do. But oftentimes there are some of those nuances about some of the nuanced reporting or how they like it, or do they want it in a Word format? Do they want it Excel? Do they want it however they want it? And that becomes part of that evolution, which then, you know, really it does segue well into bringing you into this fold, Adam, because, you know, you went for 25 years, you had your career, and now it's time to kind of make a decision about what you want to do. And so for like a second, let's talk about two things, really. First one is, did you do anything kind of in preparation for about the transition of leaving government service to come here to advise? Now, I granted, you and April have worked together for many, many years. You live very close to each other. You have a personal friendship, right? Your kids are close. I know that you're godparents to each other and families get together. So a lot of, you had a little bit of your whisperer from April, but first and foremost is, what sort of things came to mind for you when it was time to transition from government to this space? What were some of the things that kind of came to mind for you as, you know, what do I have to start preparing for?
Thank you, Eric. I probably started my process of preparing years before I was thinking about retiring or eligible. I tend to be a bit of a planner. And so I kind of wanted to get a head start on just knowing what opportunities were out there. Where did other retired agents go? And what were their experiences like once they left the government? So I tried to speak to as many retired agents as I could and followed my friends when they left to see where they went and how they enjoy their post-government life. And when it came time for me to consider retiring, I still took some time and continued at that point. Once I knew that I had the opportunity to retire when I wanted to look for what I thought was going to be the best situation. I wasn't necessarily in any great hurry to leave the government. Some of that changed earlier this year when the federal workforce was kind of under a bit of attack. And so having done some of that kind of research ahead of time and knowing what types of opportunities were out there certainly helped me to be in a better position. And then when I looked and considered what opportunities were out there, I think probably the biggest deciding factor for me was the culture. You know, I knew I wanted to continue to do investigations and remain in kind of the healthcare field, since that's where I had spent the larger part of my career. And it really was, in part, you know, having kept in contact with April during this whole time, and speaking to other people, including yourself, it really was the culture at Advise that was a deciding factor for me when I decided to leave government and to transition into like SIU work.
No, and I appreciate that. I appreciate that. And culture is an important thing, right? You want to be in an environment where you're enjoying where you are, and it's not dreadful to get out of bed every day. And when that happens, it's time to make a decision. Tell me though, you know, obviously you're the most, you're the youngest of the retirees of the group. And, you know, obviously the biggest thing is,
but he's not the youngest. He's just the newest retiree. I just want to point that out. His birthday is 3 months earlier than I am. Okay.
Yeah. I didn't say by age. I meant the youngest at the time. But you know, the thing I think that becomes one of the largest challenges for people that go from the law enforcement world into the commercial or the SIU space is, you know, the law enforcement mentality is criminal cases, civil cases, administrative cases, and referrals. And, you know, it's not necessarily about the money. Although I loved to say that if someone stole a dollar from the Medicare program, I wanted two. Because it was about the money, but it was also about making that point, that deterrence piece of the puzzle. But, you know, we know that in the SIU space, most of it is a combination of ROI, getting that money back into the payer from that malfeasance, from an administrative overpayment, and then the phrase that I had never heard until I came here, which was provider abrasion, which is, you know, tamping down the sort of the rub between the payer and the provider community. And having now been here for a few months, are you finding that that's it's a big challenge, right? Because now you're potentially looking at maybe having a caseload of 20 or 30 or 40 cases, which sometimes people would look at and think, oh my God, that's insane. But we're not talking about heavy duty criminal type investigations that require very deep dives into people's backgrounds and money laundering and this. Have you found that making that transition to, you know, getting the case resolved in whether it be 30, 60, 90, 120 days versus 3 years or 4 years, has that been a challenge? Because the SIU mentality is a lot different than the law enforcement or the government or the investigative mentality from that perspective.
Certainly, that's probably been the hardest transition that I've had, going from government investigations and criminal-based investigations to the SIU work. Yes, the term provider abrasion is something I was not familiar with. I am now very familiar with it, and I do appreciate that it has a role in SIU work. But having done investigations for, you know, criminal, civil, administrative, you also grow accustomed to certain steps that you're used to taking. And the steps for an investigation in the SIU are very different. And so it certainly takes some time to get adjusted to doing these type of investigations as opposed to the criminal investigations.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the way that I put it with people when I talk to them is no one has to show you how to, you know, we've given you the keys to the executive washroom and we just need to show you where it is. It's really about process, right? Because no one has to tell you how to do an investigation. No one has to tell you this doesn't pass your stink test and this doesn't seem right. And how do I go about trying to resolve this in the way that's the most expeditious? You know, I think we can all collectively say one of the biggest things that comes about in the SIU space is these cases don't get to linger. You know, in our past lives, cases sometimes would linger 2 years, 3 years, 4 years for a variety of reasons, some of which were in our control, some of which were not in our control. Some of them were, as people would probably say, our fault. Some of them were not our fault. It was just kind of sometimes the nature of the case. And the reality was that our job in part in our last lives was to actually go down those rabbit holes. We were supposed to do that. Whereas I think in this space, what we often find is the rabbit holes aren't really up for discussion. We want to be able to get these cases, get them resolved and move on. And I think that becomes part of the biggest challenge. And I think you're going to find, Adam, that the challenge of how your brain works in that way will abate itself pretty quickly, because you'll see that a lot of the things that you think you should be doing don't necessarily need to come to fruition to achieve those results. But I think the fact that as New Yorkers, we're fast-paced people. And we want to get these cases done quickly. So that's actually a plus, right? People have to say a lot of things about New Yorkers, the least of which is maybe our abrasiveness or not. But I think that the fact that we just want to get things done yesterday, it bodes well in the SIU space, because the SIUs and the payers, they want these cases to move quickly. They don't want to sit on them. They want them resolved. Is there an overpayment? Is there no overpayment? Is there a negotiated overpayment? What may it be? Let's kind of get there. And I think that's going to be probably one of your strongest advocates for, you know, how you mentally will deal with these things. So, you know, as we kind of get, you know, we're kind of running out of time. We don't like to spend a forever on these. We can talk about these things forever. Jason, as kind of the mentor emeritus, you know, what are some of your final thoughts for people that are, let's start with people that are in government that are looking to transition into the SIU space. And then secondarily, and it may not be a different answer, but secondarily, people that are in the SIU space who are maybe looking to make a move, what are some of the skill sets that you think become the key components to a successful career? Because I will tell you personally, when I look at a lot of resumes, I do a lot of the hiring and the interviews here. And the one thing I notice is in the SIU space, the number of people who have had a career of laterals is really surprising to me. I mean, we all can say we worked for one employer, our uncle, right? We worked for Uncle Sam. And, you know, for the most part, we didn't really move. April spent her entire career in one place. Jason spent 95% of his career in one place. Adam, you spent 95% of your career in one place, and I was, you know, 99%. So we didn't really move a lot around. But, you know, when I look at resumes and I see people who in 10 years were at six places or seven places that were mostly lateral, and, you know, you kind of wonder when you're talking to them, like, you're like, what is it you want to do when you grow up? So what are some of the skill sets that you see as being the winning things that people can do to excel in this career space?
I will answer your question, but first I just want to say to those that are listening to this, if you all think, well, you know, this, how important is this really? I'll just say that in this industry, it's extremely important. And no knock at Amazon, but at Amazon, if someone is not getting the process right, okay, I'm not getting my new Fire Stick exactly on time. In what we all do, whether it's on the OIG side, and you might be taking away somebody's freedom, extensive amount of their resources, on the SIU side, it really is the same. When you get down to it, you may not actually be doing that criminal investigation, but whether or not that is getting to OIG is going to be highly dependent on the SIU. So take this seriously, not just as I want things timely and whatnot. To answer your question about what the skill sets are, really there are two major categories. One is about the ability to communicate. You could be the smartest person ever, but if you can't write it down, if you can't articulate it sitting in front of somebody, it's probably a lost cause. It's hard to really train that. And the other part that you need to focus on is, show me how you've managed projects over time. If the person can't manage a project, again, that's to your point about some investigations linger. What I would say, after looking at many investigations over the years, it's because they weren't focused on what does it take to make this investigation a success, or cut it loose and go on to the one that can be.
Yeah, it's a great point. And the one thing that I tell people is that when you're thinking about that transition, and not that we want to make this a career counseling session for people that are looking to retire from government service to come over to the commercial side or private industry or consulting and advisory work. You know, when people say, well, how do I get project management experience when I'm just a case agent? And my response is, did you ever work a case that involved multiple defendants? Did that multiple defendant case result in multiple search warrants, arrests, trials, things of that sort? That's project management. You know, I talk oftentimes about cases where I worked 15 defendant cases with multiple ongoing search warrants, multiple arrests, and multiple trials. That's project management, like in its rawest form. You're dealing with having to coordinate multiple people, multiple tasks, and, you know, potentially travel of people coming in and out and coordinating large groups of people, particularly search warrants, which could have 10, 15, 18 people on a search warrant. You're coordinating multiple search warrants. So there are ways that you can articulate a project management and leadership experience without being a formal leader. Adam, April, and I were never in positions where we were in formal leadership roles, managerial roles, whereas Jason was. But that doesn't mean, you know, as a mentor or as a case agent, that you didn't take a leadership or managerial role. When I retired and I came over here to advise, I was immediately put into some leadership and project management roles, and I was perfectly comfortable with them because it was nothing more than an extension of what I did for 25 years. And as the company has grown probably tenfold since I came here, that has, you know, as things expand and people get opportunities to do those things, those nuggets of personal challenges remain in there. The biggest thing I think is adaptability. And I think that for us as New Yorkers, I think we tend to adapt. We tend to adapt to our environments in certain ways a lot better. I think that New Yorkers, you know, don't do well if we have to go live out in Billings, Montana. I don't think you're going to find us being very successful. But I think that we tend to be adaptable to locations. And I think one of the things that makes as a company advise is the nimbleness, I'll call it, or that flexibility of when a client calls us and has a question about something and we're like, yeah, why is that a problem? Because it's not cookie cutter. And part of the reason it's not cookie cutter is because I don't think the company has ever existed in a cookie cutter fashion. It's always been what has been the thing that you need and how do we achieve doing it? And when we have people like us here, and we've got other OIG people, right? Matt Kachansky, Wade McFall, and we've got others that we're bringing on board as well for some of our contracts. Every day was a challenge. And I think in the SIU space, what people always need to think about is every day is a challenge. Even if you've worked on 10 cardiology cases, the 11th one is going to be something that may have a slight nuance to it that you're not familiar with. Or there's a new policy out. You know, we're seeing right now with New York, there are some new reporting requirements that are coming out that we have to deal with. And, you know, you kind of just adapt and you overcome and you kind of figure it out. So, it's an interesting thing. I'm super excited when I know that I'm bringing people here that I know personally, that I've worked with, or I know reputationally people that have come from our background. I don't know of a lot of companies that are out there that have a heavy concentration of retired OIG people. And I think the biggest thing is that we don't really say no, because we just kind of do it. Give us our assignment, we'll do it and move on to the next one. So, you know, we'll do this again sometime when we decide that we need to take a break from our regularly scheduled OIG roundtable programming. And we'll do that. It's good to see that we're all in the same conference room, but we're on different floors. I never realized that the advised corporate office was a minimum of 4 conference room floors. So as always, listen, it's great to see you guys. It's good to get us together and see your smiling faces. And as always, we appreciate everybody who tunes in every week to the OIG Roundtable podcast. As always, you can get our podcasts delivered right to your inbox on Fridays. Just go up onto advise, advizehealth.com. You can sign up for our newsletter, get this right to your inbox on Fridays. For those of you that are on LinkedIn, you can sign up and get this right to your feed. Just join us on LinkedIn. We've got about 60,000 followers and continue to grow and always trying to put out good content. We've got some great LinkedIn Lives scheduled for the next few months, scheduled with some great speakers, some great presentations on data analytics, some case-related fraud schemes and the like. And so we're here to help. Drop us a note. Again, you can catch us on our website, advisehealth.com. And if you want to see any of our prior OIG roundtables, our prior LinkedIn Lives, you can catch those on Spotify. You can catch those off of our webpage, and you can catch them off of our YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube, do a search for Advise Health, and click that subscribe button, and you can see us. So until next time, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.